Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
Okay, you're on your own, it's late. Your girlfriend is on another date with the hero in your dream. Turn around, ask yourself, so you think you're gonna win this time, man, child?
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Today's guest may be known for her huge success in the 80s with massive singles like Buffalo Stance and Manchild, but scratch a little deeper and there's a whole world of musical heritage and influences before and since then. As well as being a restless musical experimenter, she's also a British hip-hop hero. My guest here on The First Time this week is Nina Cherry. Here she talks about her artistic musical journey from her birth in Sweden to a childhood within the New York jazz scene, her leap to the UK for the tail end of punk rock, and her first bands like The Slits and Rip Rig and Panic. We also look at the world-conquering success of her 1989 debut album, Raw Like Sushi, that famous appearance on Top of the Pops while 7 months pregnant, and her gradual disillusionment with fame. She also discusses some of her many collaborations with people like Yusu and Dur, experimental jazz group The Thing, Damon Albarn, and her recent album Blank Project, recorded with Fortet's Kieran Hebden and synth drum duo Rocket No. 9. But I started, as I do with all my guests, by asking Nina when she was first aware of music.
The first time I was aware of music, well, I think my awareness of kind of discovering music for myself happened on a swing. My mother used to hang swings in our house. And I can remember we had this place in Vermont. My stepdad was like the music professor at Dartmouth University. So we were living in Vermont for a while and I was on my swing and I was listening to Sly and the Family Stone.
That's a very cool artist to start off with.
And I remember just the thing of, and then we also had, because my dad was a trip, he always used to go out and buy all kinds of records. He was just like, he was into like the world of music kind of thing. So we also had the first Jackson 5 record, which was like Diana Ross presents the Jackson 5. So those were like two records. I can remember getting into, you know, getting off my swing, and I was probably old enough to put them on. It's like my earliest memory of having a relationship with songs. It's not maybe, obviously there was always music around me like my whole life. So so before then, I'd obviously soaked up stuff, but that's like a memory of choosing something and wanting to hear it again and again, and remembering the kind of the force of being on my swing and swinging to the songs. And I was definitely fascinated by the Jackson 5 and, you know, looking at the cover. And obviously they were kids, but, you know, older kids, older than me. But there was definitely a fascination. Ooh, your love is fading. I can feel your love fading. Girl is fading. Go away from me. Cause your touch has grown cold. As if someone else controls your face.
Jazz has played a huge part in your life. Who were the first jazz artists that really made an impression on you when you were growing up? Because it's something you've kind of come back to again and again in your career, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who were the kind of touchstones?
I think that for me, the sort of direct connection to jazz is like, I can draw from it now, from my spine. Like, so I think that in a way, when I was growing up, the people that were around who, you know, like my stepdad was working with it, who were friends with my parents and stuff. I mean, they were people we knew. And, you know, I think it's hard for me to kind of actually look at who I was into then when I was a kid.
Well, because they were family friends.
Because they were family friends. And obviously I could sense, like, with my dad that he was very much, like, when we'd go to Ornette Coleman's house, that he was someone that my dad really looked up to. Like, you could sense in him in a way that Ornette was like a kind of guru for him. And he always used to play a lot of Thelonious Monk in the house and Coltrane. And at one point, we lived in a building in Brooklyn when I was 2 years old. And some of my very early memories are from that 1966. My first memory is like seeing a cockroach on the floor and going to my dad, "What's that?" And he went, "That's ugly." So sometimes when someone goes to me, like says the word ugly, I just get like a little. But I think the impression, it runs deep because I'd been living in Sweden, or we'd been living in Sweden. It was the first time I ever went to New York. But the reason why I started talking about it is because Coltrane rehearsed in that building, and Ornette Coleman and someone else had rehearsal studios. So I've always liked the story of my mother going, "Yeah, and you know, we used to go upstairs when Coltrane was rehearsing, and he always used to say how sweet you were and take you on his lap." That was music. That music was like the sound of my upbringing.
Of your daily life.
Of my daily life. And a lot of the people that were around were like amazing musicians and people. But, you know, you have to find things out for yourself. And what I really shared with my dad was listening to records, you know, because he would go out and come back with Chaka Khan and Earth, Wind and Fire. And we would sit and kind of journey through the record player, you know, what was the vinyl that we had. And so I think for me, the discovery of the meaning of the jazz, that's kind of happened to me as I've been on my own journey, like with when I joined Rip Ring and Panic, meeting people, like coming to London, that were really into Sun Ra and to my dad's music, and kind of thinking, oh yeah, well, I know that stuff, but that's it, you know.
What was the first... Because yeah, if you could kick against that, you could try and find your own thing that's radically different. What were the first records that you bought that you were like, "This is mine. This doesn't belong to anyone else. This speaks to me."
I bought you won't believe it.
Go on.
Right. This is like, I bought a Donny Osmond record once.
You're surrounded by all this incredible music, yeah, and you think, yeah, "No, I will react by buying Donny Osmond."
I bought a Donny Osmond record.
Which one?
When I was about 10, like some solo record of his, and it was like, that's what everybody that I went to school with was listening to. Donny Osmond, Sweet, you know. But that's another story. But then when I was like 11, going on 12, I went and lived with my family in L.A., in the Compton area. And I had my first boyfriend there, like fell in love for the first time. And culturally, like the stack of records that I bought with me from there back to Sweden, it was like the music broke my heart, but it also kept me alive because I was lovesick. And, you know, we were coming from, me and my brother traveled back by ourselves from Los Angeles to Sweden to go and stay with our grandparents, from the sunshine into the dark, cold kind of weirdness of Sweden. And the records I had with me from that trip were Songs in the Key of Life, Johnny Guitar Watson, Ain't That a Bitch, Denise Williams, Free, The Emotions, who were produced by, I think, maybe some of Earth, Wind and Fire, Parliament, right? Yeah, that was like, that became the kind of soundtrack to my existence.
Clinging on to these records.
I was clinging on to those records.
Like a life support.
Yeah, yeah. That was like a very important bunch of records for me.
Sing to me, it's everything that it should be. Loving you the way I do should be crystal clear to you. You got a thing for me, even the blind could see something you got. Can't beat it. Oh, well. You got weakens me. I give in like 1, 2, 3. Sometime I do something wrong. We hug and kiss and it's all gone. Ain't that cool? You got a thing for me. Even the blind could see something you got. Can't beat it.
Could see something you got. You sure can't beat it. You know I got to have it, yeah. I can't do without it. That's it, I need. And I need.
Oh, no,
oh, girl, I need. No, 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 no.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week, Nena Cherry. And just before that, you heard Johnny Guitar Watson with I Need It, a seminal record for Nena. Having moved to London to witness the final embers of punk rock die out, Nena joined a few bands, including The Slits, before hooking up with post-punk outfit Rip Rig and Panic, appearing on their 1981 debut single, Go Go Go, This Is It.
It's funny, I listened to it not that long ago, and I was kind of, in a way, quite happy to discover that it still sounded quite timeless and that it kind of made sense. Because, you know, some things you can go back and listen to, you think, ah, I don't know, yeah, in its own time and place. But, you know, all of that, for me, was like, I mean, I wouldn't be sitting here if I hadn't have done that. And like I said just a while ago, like what was kind of a trip was coming here and meeting like Ari and Tessa and Viv Albertine from The Slits and Gareth Sager and Sean Oliver, Bruce Smith. You know, they were sort of in transition between the pop group and Rip Rig and Panic. And, you know, those guys, Gareth and Bruce and stuff, they were kind of responsible for introducing like The Slits to jazz. I think they'd taken them to the North Sea Jazz Festival where they'd seen Sun Ra and stuff. And later, when The Slits were doing this tour here, they invited Don, my stepdad, Don Cherry, to play on the tour, and he took me along, and that's where I met everybody. And then a few months, and I was spending some time here, and I'd gone back to New York, and, you know, got this call from Gareth and Bruce and Sean, who were doing Rip Rig and Panic, and just asking me if I'd come and sing. And I can remember I was lying in the bath and I took the call and I was like, oh, okay, I'll just have a think about it. And I was standing there kind of looking at my mother like, this is really weird. I just had this call asking if I'd sing. And I was, I just sort of thought, well, what can I lose? Shit, you know, I've got to just... So I went back to London. I made my way back somehow, got enough airfare together. And then the first track we ever did was Go, 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 This Is It. And we were in the studio, Berry Street Studios, which apparently still exists. And I can remember Gareth just sort of playing me the track. And Gareth was the songwriter and wrote all the lyrics in Rip Rig. And he just kind of showed me how it went. And then, you know... I kind of got in the cans and I just sort of thought, okay, I don't know what the hell I'm doing, but I'm just going to let it happen. You know, we'll just see. And I think I was just more determined to not freeze and be intimidated by the fear, because I definitely had the fear. But I just thought, like, what the heck? And so that was like the first thing that I'd ever kind of recorded, I think, properly like that. I'm not sure what led me or how I got through. And I suppose in a way, that is the power of music. I mean, I still feel that thing when it happens, when you're driven by music. It's like you can be completely petrified before you start. And then as it happens, and it was like that working with The Thing, you know, when I first worked with them and with the guys who I've been recording with now with Rocket Number 9. It's a kind of thing, I think, where you just have to
face the fear.
Surrender and face the fear and just sort of go, okay, well, if it's awful, we'll just go again. You know, and I think that kind of spontaneity is a wonderful kind of magic thing.
It's the Brian Eno thing. It's like, it's only art. You can start again. It doesn't
matter.
Yeah,
it is only art. You can start again or whatever it is, you know?
I followed that bead of sweat to the small of your back from the nape of your neck, lighting it up with every drag upon my cigarette.
Slow Train to Dawn by The from 1987, featuring on backing vocals my guest on this week's first time, Nena Cherry.
This is Six Music.
Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music.
Take a look. How melodic.
Welcome back, I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Nana Cherry. And that song you just heard, as if you need telling, was Buffalo Stance from 1988, taken from her debut album Raw Like Sushi, a track that would become a huge global hit, changing Nana's life forever. We have to ask you about Buffalo Stance, which came out in 1988. When it first came out, can you remember people's reaction to it?
I think the wonderful thing with a track like Buffalo Stance was that it was always very immediate. And I think that's the thing with that track. It's always had a fairly direct effect.
Yeah, it's one of those songs.
It's one of those songs. And, I mean, I suppose even the process of recording it and doing it was a bit pretty immediate in a way, because Tim knew what he wanted to do. There was another version of it, which was on the B-side of this Morgan McVeigh record, which Nellie Hooper and one of the guys from the Wild Bunch, DJ Milo, we'd done it with them, just as a quick style B-side, slightly more clubby kind of thing. And Tim had heard that. So I was working with Cam and a few other people on Raw Like Sushi, and Tim just sort of turned up at my house one day. We'd arranged to meet, but like just really feeling a vibe for that track and wanting to do it. So he was kind of like forgotten, you know. I mean, if it wasn't for Tim, it would have been just left
just a B-side.
To the B-side of, yeah, of Looking Good Diving. When we went in and recorded it, I suppose that that energy that we had, which was straightforward, just
in your face,
letting it roll, taking it and capturing it as we went along, is in there in the record. I mean, it was done in a pretty unself-conscious way. But it's funny. I mean, I think that it's an amazing thing to have a few things in my life where you can feel that you've been part of something that had a kind of magic, you know? And it's like not something you can go back and recreate, but there was definitely something about that track that summed up that time and place and, you know, where we all were in our heads. And to me, it's also like a synopsis of maybe my journey between being 15 and 25. You know, it just whatever gave me a chance to celebrate that little ditty.
Money, shattered dreams, it ain't funny.
when Raw Like Sushi came out, did you enjoy the amount of success when it first came out? Because your profile was so high, and there was... When you just appeared on Top of the Pops and the world seemed to go quite crazy for a while, did you enjoy that attention? Were you ready for it, do you think?
I think that I was able to just ride it, you know? I think that, myself and Cameron, we'd built a posse, a family, a kind of think tank, a body of people around what we were doing. And we were pretty self-sufficient. We were running the office and all of it, really, from our little house and just in Kensal Green. And I think that in a way we kind of moved into it as a family, you know, and so I felt really protected. And I suppose also it's like, I mean, if you can go in and pretty much as you can be who you are. I mean, I never felt that I had to affect, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, I got pregnant. Maybe it wasn't the best time to get pregnant, but I certainly had the most amazing child from it. And once I was pregnant, I was like, well, I wasn't not going to have the baby. So it just had to happen with all the other stuff that was going on. It wasn't maybe planned. It wasn't schemed. Do you know what I mean? But it was amazing. It just set a kind of arena and a picture and a story that was happening really naturally. But it also became like a force, like a kind of protection.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I hadn't really been out. Well, I hadn't been out there, you know, in that dimension as a solo artist. I'd always been in bands and in a far more bohemian place than all of this ended up with. So I think it just made it a very matter of fact. This is how we're going to roll. And I felt kind of headstrong. I mean, like, I can't always say that I've known exactly where I'm going or how or why, but I've kind of known, like, what I didn't want to do kind of thing or where I didn't want to end up. I think people have sort of questioned, well, like, why did you throw it away? Or, you know, where did you go for 18 years? It's like, well, I've been doing lots of stuff, but just like, maybe there isn't lots of product to show for it, but that doesn't mean that it hasn't been important. But I mean, I think that, yeah, maybe like my real home isn't in that lane of that very mainstream thing. And so I think I feel very at home where I am now, actually.
If I could only be like I always wanted, pictures in the magazines might seem more certain, but somewhere in between the lines, there's no plain reading, and you know that's why you put scales on me. My soul returnable, exchangeable, impressionable. My price tag sealed by date, replaceable like vegetables. I think I'm built to last, can change your past, it was a blast. They think you're losing time, you realign, you treat me like cash.
You can't.
Another key track in Nena's career was the 1994 single 7 Seconds, which he recorded with legendary Senegalese singer and cultural hero Youssou N'Dour, a track that would prove a massive international hit and would introduce Youssou to a huge mainstream audience. I asked her about that first meeting and how that led to the song's creation.
I kind of had a family connection to Youssou. He had two managers who had worked with my dad. So there was a family connection and a dialogue that happened through that. And he'd played actually out in the countryside when he was really young, out around in the area where I grew up. And then I'd met him a few times at some festivals when he was playing with Peter Gabriel and stuff, sort of quite early days. With Youssou, there seemed to be a cultural and, for us, like a meeting that we felt was really necessary of the kind of the world, in a way, but on a very small scale for us, because, of course, we were like writing in a studio that was a quarter of the size of this when we did it. So it wasn't maybe that we were thinking about that on a global scale, but just that thing of like that anything's possible. Mm. And wanting him to sing in Wolof and his second language, French, and then I didn't do anything in Swedish, but...
You should have, that would have been great.
I could have, maybe. But, yeah, like, taking it all and doing something with all the different things that we had.
You sort of drew attention to it as well, this sort of idea that you fell out of the public eye and, you know, there was the story, oh, she's had Lyme disease, then she's going off, then she's disappeared again. But actually, you work with people all the time. You have always worked with people all the time. I was looking at this, Peter Gabriel, Timo Maas, Craig Armstrong, Christian Falk and Gorillaz. You've never really not been away, but the perception is that you have been, which is strange.
If people can't see you and if you're not, like, if the product isn't there, you're not in the public eye, then it's sort of like you don't exist. But I mean,
how did you meet Damon and work with Gorillaz?
Damon was actually, he has a relative that works with him in the studio and stuff, who'd been working as a sort of tape op, whatever, at our little studio that we had in Primrose Hill. And he went over to work with Damon and they started making the album. I don't know whether he made a suggestion or whether Damon, who, you know, I've bumped into quite a few times over the years, and I think that at some point I think I'd said to him, oh, can't we do something together sometime? Anyway, I got a call, which was really exciting, and a rough, very rough cut of Kids With Guns, and then I wrote some things and went to the studio that he had then in Kensal Road, and we did one version, and then Danger Mouse was around when we did the next version, and it's something that I'm really proud and honored to have been part of.
Kids with guns, kids with guns, taken over by one belong. They mesmerize skeletons. Kids with guns, kids with guns, easy does it. Does it easy? Does it make up something to say?
Does it turn into monsters? Turning into fire? Turning into monsters? It's all desire, it's all desire, it's all desire.
Drinking out, pacify, taking soul, where you are. Doesn't make sad too, but it won't be long. Cause kids with guns, kids with guns, easy does it, easy does it. They got something to say.
When did you first meet Kieran Hebden from Fortet, who you work with on this new record?
I actually met Kieran for the first time about 2 years ago in Norway. I've been a fan and been listening to him for a really long time. I adore his music. I was doing The Thing then, and the guy who has the label, he has a small festival every... I mean, it's actually not that small, but it's like a kind of conference type thing in Oslo. And Kieran was there to DJ, and I went with Cameron, my husband, to meet with Kieran. We talked about working together, and it just felt very right as soon as we sat down and had like some tapas, or, you know, had lunch together. But he just started sending some backing tracks, and I was writing stuff. You know, Rocket Number 9 came into the picture, and they go back, Rocket Number 9 and Kieran. He's released their music and they've worked together. And so then in a way it kind of made even more sense.
It's very stripped down, very immediate. Your voice is right up there in the mix, which it sounds great. It's very no frills. This is you.
There's no frills at all. And to tell you the truth...
Scary?
Scared me. Like, doing it, like I said, I think it was very strong and really powerful. And it was really natural, the way that we did it. And to have Kieran there in the driver's seat, I mean, he just knew how he wanted it to be and feel and sound, made it possible for me and Tom and Ben from Rocket Number 9 to just open up and flower in a way, you know? But when we left, I mean, I didn't listen to it for about a month.
Too scared.
Because I felt, well, I did feel really naked. But then I came back to it and I was like, no, this is the truth. I don't know, you know, without being like, oh, it was all about making this super righteous record. But I think it is how it needed to be. Yeah. So I accepted it. And now I'm really happy that it is like this.
I'm skipping down the street, just trying to mind my business. I've got my blinkers on, so bad stuff I can't witness. I see the wolf packs congregating on the corners, hiding their cutbacks while attending to the mourners. Tie your hands behind the backs, wash your mouths, face the pack. Out of the black, out of the blue, I just want you.
In the way that a lot of the things we've been talking about, this idea of just family and the connection with that, and it's all one big interlaced series of collaborations. It's a nice way to work, anyway.
And I think that I'm very conscious of like how things come together and why they come together, and that it is really a lot of it is about the chemistry and the people that are around that makes that able to happen, whatever that is, you know, that thing that becomes the work, the body of work, the album, the product.
Without using the word product.
Yeah, without using the word product. So it is really about the people, you know, around. And in this case, it was Rocket Number 9 and Kieran, and the spirit of what we did is in the record.
And the last thing, we've had all these firsts. Let's do the last, which means you get to pick the last song. It can be something new, it can be something old, it can be something you heard this morning, it can be one of the tracks you used to play on your record player when you were little. What should we finish the show with?
I'd probably like to play something off Science Fiction, Ornette Coleman. There's two tracks with a woman singing, one of them which I did for the Cherry Thing, which would be What Reason. So we could take that.
We'll play that song.
Yeah, great.
Thank you very much. It's good to speak to you.
Nice to talk to you.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Music Jukebox.
Like the legend of the Phoenix, all ends with beginnings. What keeps the planet spinning? Force from the beginning.